Welcome to Talking Walking, hosted by Andrew Stuck from Rethinking Cities and the Museum of Walking. Talking Walking brings you interviews with people from the world of walking, artists, activists, professionals, and those of us who have a passion for just taking a walk. I planned meeting up with Australian Kim Goldsmith some time in advance, knowing that she'd be returning from a residency on Skye with her partner and would only have a short time in London. They were staying in a hotel just south of King's Cross, so I met them there with the intention of finding quiet spaces nearby in which to record an interview. I accompanied Kim on a walk towards the Camney Street Nature Reserve and Old St Pancras Churchyard, both of which I assumed would be quiet, calm spaces. Kim is a sound recordist and a digital storyteller and considers herself an environmental artist. Like others whom I've recorded who have a practice in sound, it would seem inevitable that wherever we go, sounds and noises intrude on our conversation. The interview with Kim was no exception, as you'll discover. The good news is that Kim took it in very good spirits. What could possibly go wrong? We're here in London, and you've just said to me this isn't in King's Cross, and it's not really a territory that you've really explored, but perhaps you better explain where you come from and the kind of territory you normally explore.
Sure. So I live in the middle of New South Wales, about 6 hours west of Sydney, Australia, and I've been in the UK now for 6 weeks, so second time in London on this trip. But yes, we've only seen a very little bit so far.
Tell us a bit more about what you get up to when you're in 6 hours west of Sydney.
So I live on 25 acres, which is considered peri-urban, on the outskirts of a regional city. I do a lot of things. So I'm a content producer. I write. I produce videos and soundscapes and sound walks. But I also have a digital media practice with a real focus on sound and writing.
Now, I thought I'd choose this route because I thought it'd be quieter. Actually, we're completely surrounded by urban drill and drum and hum. What's the soundscape like where you live?
Well, the contrast couldn't be greater, to be honest. So, I mean, being peri-urban, you still get noise from people living in close proximity to each other, and I think I mentioned to you earlier that that's things like dirt bikes and chainsaws and lawnmowers. But on the whole, we have a lot of space around us, and my immediate vicinity, my home vicinity, is very much bird song, wind in the trees, a general sense of calm and quiet compared to a city environment like this. But I do tend to go further west into much more remote areas. So again, you know, that sense of quiet is much greater, and the diversity of sound is obviously much greater, particularly once you start to get those more than human sounds.
We first encountered Kim Goldsmith when she entered one of our writing competitions.
Yeah, that was just a bit of summer fun. I come from a journalism background, so I originally worked for ABC Radio as a rural reporter. So I studied agriculture and journalism, grew up on a farm, and so it was sort of fairly natural for me to move into that area, and it's still part of my expertise. But I also ended up, once I left the ABC and working as a communications consultant, worked very much in the natural resources sector.
So you really understand the managed landscape around you, but you also know something about the wilderness too.
Yeah, I guess that's interesting, this idea between managed landscapes and the wild or the wilderness and what that actually means. And I think we've got to come to terms with the idea that we are part of that environment and that it does require our care, if not management, and that no wild place really exists without our human input in some way.
Well, I mean, definitely in the UK, we find it hard to find any wilderness at all.
But yeah.
Not that long ago, you did an exchange project with a fellow sound recordist or field recordist. Can you explain a little bit about that? Because he was working in almost wilderness.
Yes, well, Andrew Howe and I got paired through Arts Territory Exchange in about 2018. And it took us a while to sort of work out how each of us worked and what we wanted to do. And he has a background in environmental consultancy as well. And so what we worked out was that we had these Ramsar listed wetlands nearby. Mine was sort of 2.5 hours away. His was half an hour away. And we sort of thought, well, let's explore those and explore the issues around those and see where that goes. Yeah, that project in some ways is still continuing today. It's had exhibitions, it's had a book. We've just done a series of walks in the mosses. It's been quite interesting to sort of see how that project's evolved over time.
Well, if we wait till the train goes on, yes, that might be... Well, this is rather good ambience.
It's lovely sound. It's rhythmic. Make music out of that. That's amazing sound.
So let's go on this side of the road.
Okay.
This is known as the dead centre of London because there are more people buried here than you can imagine.
Yeah, right.
So, we've got all sorts. It's good fun, actually, isn't it? The sort of ambience of the city.
Yes, completely different to home.
Okay, so tell us a bit more about Andrew Howe.
Yeah, so...
And whereabouts is this? Where's Andrew
so
based?
So Andrew Howe's based in Shrewsbury in Shropshire. And he's close to Wicksaw Moss in particular. And we looked at creating a project around the ecology of the wetlands, but also the social ecology of the wetlands. So what the communities were doing and thinking and feeling about the future of these wetlands in a changing climate. And the project became called Mosses and Marshes. It was the working title, but it kind of stuck. What we sort of did was exchanged ideas and information. We had an international online forum. We talked about the issues that we'd been unearthing and got local perspectives on those and what people imagined for the future of them. And I guess our creative work that came out of that in either sort of two-dimensional or three-dimensional or sound works that I did were really trying to give a voice to those communities and give a voice to the more than human communities of those wetlands.
And in your own territory, how far did you go to have to find similar, or were you not looking for a similar?
Well, I don't think we couldn't. They weren't similar environments. They were both Ramsar listed wetlands, which means they're wetlands of international importance. So they both had that status. The climate and the geography.
The one thing I didn't want, and you get a chopper. Fair way. Yeah, it's gone away. Okay, you were mid-flow.
And I guess in terms of those landscapes, they're vastly different. The scale is probably the first thing that you notice, in that the Macquarie Marshes is about 200,000 hectares, and I think the Mosses is something like 10% of that. So the scale is quite different, but then so is the climate, so is the terrain. You know, there's obviously a lot more water in a peat-based moss than there is in, I guess, what is sometimes an ephemeral wetland, and the wetting and drying cycles of our Australian wetlands, the dry cycles are just as important as the wet cycles. The change in climate is having a greater impact on those drying cycles. And I guess that's the fear for their future. Can they rebound in the time frames that we have these days?
Okay, well, that's part of your passion, isn't it? Is that you want to try and find a better way that we can tell the story of climate change through sound. But also, what I'm also interested in is how you actually go about and record a soundscape in a wetland. I've seen pictures of you down on your knees, but you use special mics. And,
yes.
And what are we listening to?
So I do use specialist microphones. I mean, atmospheric recordings are important because they are kind of like your scene setter. But what I do like to do is take people below the surface. So I use hydrophones, contact microphones, geophones that allow me to record beneath the water, inside trees. I can capture aquatic plants, photosynthesizing in the afternoon sun. I can record the sound of aquatic plants taking up water through the mud into their roots. And basically what I do is revisit sites over a period of time, so that when I go to put a soundscape composition together, they're very multi-layered, and that basically compresses that landscape into a short period of time where you get access to all the different layers of sound.
The actual kit that you use when you listed off those different microphones, are they things that you've had to sort of make and adapt yourself, or are they now kind of more easily purchasable on eBay or Etsy?
Yeah, they're made by specialist technicians, I guess, and often they're field recorders. So they know what those pieces of equipment need to do, and there's quite a few of them around the world now making this specialist equipment. So it's about being part of that community to know what's coming on and what it is that I'm missing. I mean, that it was really my intense interest in those subsurface recordings that kind of led me to put a kit together of specialist microphones for that.
Let's ask you a bit more about trying to communicate with people about climate change and how that actually happens on the ground. But you try to do this with sound. Perhaps explain more to the listener what that's about.
Yeah, look, it's really, I mean, for people who are very familiar with an environment, and in rural communities, people who live in those communities already know them like the back of their hand. But what I want to do is present them in a new light and in a new way that gives a different perspective on what might actually be happening beneath the surface. And so sound is the way of doing that. I mean, we can't hear some of those sounds without that specialist equipment. And so I guess that's my hope, is that it provokes a conversation about, well, what are we doing now and what is the impact of what we're doing now? What do we want this place to sound like in future? Do we want to have access to these sounds in future? And if so, then what have we got to do to make that happen? So it's the action at the end of that that I think is probably more important.
I mean, how do you know what you're recording is what you think you're recording? I mean, I have a great chum who's a birdsong recordist. I tease him occasionally because I sort of say to him, well, how do you actually know that that's the long, crested, whatever it is you think it is? For him, at least, there are times that you can actually see the creature. What's going on? I mean, I imagine you can see the mosses. You can probably use a hand lens to see some of these incredible things. But how do you know you're actually recording that and something else?
On Sky, I actually was recording moss, as in moss itself that might grow in the mosses. And somebody asked that very question of me, how do you know it's the moss? And I said, well, I recorded it at three different sites on two different microphones over the period of about an hour, and then I actually repeated that the next day. And I narrowed it down to the point where it could only be the moss. You do have to validate what it is that you're actually hearing. And one of the things I often tell people these days is that, I mean, I've been field recording since the 90s in some form or another, is that you spend much more time just listening than recording. And so you need to make sure that it's not a technical interference sometimes. And by testing your equipment and listening for long periods of time, in some cases, by the time you actually hit the record button, you're pretty sure you know what you've got.
Okay, so tell us a little bit more about Sky. You've had a month on Sky. Someone's paid you to stay there and visit? Self-finance, was it?
Self-finance. I spent a lot of time writing grant applications, and for once I just wanted to take the pressure off. So having spent the last 5 years in a really crazy mode of projects and having applied for a lot of grants, I was really keen just to have time to think more about how we write about sound, so that people who can't hear, whether they've never been able to hear or they're hearing impaired, might have access to the real magic that's in some sonic worlds. I mean, it's hard to describe, but you're only ever going to get part of the picture if you can't. And there's that helicopter again.
Keep going.
You only ever get part of the picture if you can't hear something. And so really what I wanted to do was some intense periods of attentive listening, some experimentation, and really start to try and form the vocabulary around what those subsurface sounds are in particular, because they're actually the hardest ones to write about. Tactile elements to try and express what they might feel like and even taste. I mean, some of the mosses and lichens on the trees on Skye are amazing, and so they're really gnarly and rough, and you know, then some of the mosses are really soft, and so they're velvety, and you can describe them in those ways. But then how do I describe those trickling, stream-like sounds that I actually heard through those microphones?
How long were you on Skye?
I was on Skye for 4 weeks, and I guess during that time I probably spent 5 days a week in the studio. So 2 days a week was sort of spent either doing domestic duties or just day tripping and getting a feel for the island.
What do you think to Skye? Will you ever go back?
I need to be diplomatic here. Look, beautiful island, beautiful people, but the impact of tourism on Skye has been something else to observe, and it worries me greatly that some of the behaviour I saw and the impact on some of the landmarks on Skye, I think, you know, the damage that's being done, you know, is irreversible in some ways. So I don't know what the future holds for islands like Skye. Tourism's obviously a major part of its economy, but it's quite unsustainable.
Where you live and where you come from in Australia, is that a tourist area or is it not?
Yes, it has become that, particularly food and wine and cultural tourism's growing in central west New South Wales. But we have a lot more space. We have wider roads. We sort of have more space for camping. But at the same time, I think it's a really good point in time to think about what is sustainable going forward. Is there room to grow it? And particularly for those creatives involved in that cultural tourism, the ones I spoke to on Skye are in this hamster wheel of having to make like mad over the winter when everything's closed, just so they have enough product for the summer to sell to the tourists. And that leaves very, very little creative energy or time for them to just be creative. I guess it depends on the business model of your creative business. Yes, certainly it would create a lot of problems, I know, for artists at home if that was what they were expected to do. And we don't really shut down over winter like they do on Skye. So that would then become a 12-month-a-year type process of ensuring you had enough product for a tourist market. When do you have the time to just create?
You've been talking about creatives, and it'd be interesting to explore a bit more about what you feel creatives can do in making work, especially around the environment, ecology, and also sound.
Giving a voice to the non-human, I think, is one of the first things we need to do. We spend a lot of time talking about the environment. In a way, it's become this sort of shapeless entity or a catch-all to talk about something quite abstract. And instead of really looking at the detail of what makes up that environment and the ecosystems within it that we're part of, but giving a voice to the more than human in that, I think, is something that we need to do a lot more of. I've been doing it for a while. There are other artists who are doing it, but we still, a lot of creatives are still incredibly human-centric in their approach. And it's not to say that humans aren't an important part of the story. Obviously, they are. But I think we need to sort of rebalance the scales a bit.
Is it just climate change? No.
No, it's not more. It's not just climate change. And I think it's really about telling the stories in your own backyard. I mean, I've just done an artist residency on Skye, but that was about giving me some distance and space to really think about what I'd done and where I want to go. The stories that I tell through my work all come from my backyard, and I think more artists need to be doing that, because there's an authenticity in that storytelling that I find missing in a lot of work. at the moment. Having that ability to connect with an environment in whatever way makes sense to you is really the starting point for thinking more deeply about what we want in our future.
Okay, and the other thing is, I do is I ask people to recommend a couple of walks. They could be one from Sky, they could be one from home, they could be entirely conceptual, they could be just a listening walk, you know.
Okay, so one of the easiest walks that anybody can access is to walk around their backyard, helicopters and all.
Yeah.
Because you can actually, the more you attentively listen and practice attentive listening, the more you can actually block out some of those sounds that you don't want to hear. I led a walk along the Macquarie River at home, and we talked about listening in layers and talked about focusing on those sounds that you want to be hearing and then really just blocking out those sounds that you don't want to hear. And I had a participant in that walk from last year come back to me months later who said that it had completely revolutionised her weekly walk along the river. That now she doesn't hear the barking dogs or the traffic, that she's been able to really focus on those things in that riverine environment that mean something more to her. And I think that's probably an important skill to learn in what's becoming, you know, a really intensely sonically overcrowded world.
Okay, so that's one.
One. And the second one, well, again, you know, so that's a backyard walk that anyone can do. The second one I'm going to recommend is one that I'm actually guiding in a few weeks' time, and that will be in the Macquarie Marshes. So there's a property called Barama that has a 2 kilometre boardwalk through the wetlands. It's a long way. It's about 2.5 hours from the nearest city, but well worth it once you get there. Barama has a website, so if you just use a search engine and look for the Barama Boardwalk, and if you're in Australia, it's certainly easy. You just register your car, you book for a car spot on the property for the day, and then it's yours to access and explore.
You've been listening to Talking Walking, brought to you by Rethinking Cities and the Museum of Walking. In this episode, you've heard from Kim Goldsmith. If you have any views on this interview or any walking issues, we'd love to hear from you. Just follow the links on the Talking Walking website. We look forward to having you along for future episodes of Talking Walking. Written, recorded and produced by Andrew Stark of Rethinking Cities Limited. Our artwork is designed by Ian Martin of Aardvark Graphics, and the music is composed by Simon Sanders of Easytronic.